And, you know, first of all, I want to, you know, I'm gonna do like a 20-minute disclaimer. You know, so if any of you get your program all messed up on account of this workshop, you know, I don't want you to, my group doesn't want you to blame it on them, is really what the deal is here. So, you know, like Joyce had shared last night, you know, when she called me and, you know, and she talked about the sharing part, you know, that's no big deal. I don't mind doing that at all. But, you know, when she talked about, you know, doing a workshop, you know, an all-day workshop thing, you know, my first absolute positive response is, no, I don't do that. You know, I just don't do that. I've never done anything like that, and I just don't do that. And she said, well, we think you can do it. And, and right away, you know, that positive reinforcement, well, I don't know that I can do it, but it's just like she said, you know, I said, well, you know, I need to talk to my sponsor about it, and I need to pray about it. You know, these are things that I absolutely have to do when I don't know what I'm doing. And so I did those things. And, you know, and when I talked with my sponsor, we talked about what it was that I could talk about, and, you know, and I don't want to necessarily take you through steps or traditions or anything else like that, but, you know, we talked about experience, strength, and hope, you know, because that's all any of us have. That's really all, and then that's all I have that I can share with you is my experience, strength, and hope. You know, I don't have the answers for everybody. I don't pretend to. You know, and what I've gotten here are the answers that work for me. You know, they may not work for you, but these are the things that work for me, and I can only share with you what actually worked for me. And you know, and I did a bunch of notes because I'm an organizer. You know, my job in real life is I'm a secretary to a president of an aerospace company. You know, and on my reviews they write Larsine takes total control of the office. You know, you can get paid for that stuff. You know, I mean, and that's a good thing. You know, but again, I have to remember that I do that where I get paid for it, you know, and not take it in, you know, into my home life and other areas of my life and stuff. So, you know, and so I've made a bunch of notes, but, you know, the truth of the matter is I don't know that I can talk from notes. You know, when I'm doing work things, and those are things that require notes and things to go by, you know, when I talk from Al-Anon, you know, what I've been taught pretty much from the beginning is, you know, is we talk from the heart. You know, I can't decide, you know, what's going to be profound for me that day or not for me. And it's the same thing, because I said I made all these notes, but, and I'm sure when I wrote them, they were very eloquent, you know, and had a lot of meaning. But it's just like in my One Day at a Time, My Courage to Change book, you know, when I read the book every year, I fold down, earmark the pages that, for whatever reason, really impacted me that day, you know. I mean, it was just the message that I needed to hear. And it's so funny, because then the next year when I go back, and then, you know, like, huh? What did this mean to me that day? And then a page I didn't fold down this year has significant, you know, because to me, being an Al-Anon, it's all about change. You know, I'm in a constant state of change. You know, and some days, you know, and weeks, months, I'm just going through Al-Anon, and it's a smooth road, you know, and other times, there's not anything even particularly that's going on, but there's turmoil going on in my head, and I don't know if that's because I'm trying to take control again, or, you know, those things are going on. So it's just a constant state of change for me. So like I say, you know, they may make sense to me now, and I may look at this stuff and go, okay, well, let's move on. And that's what I'm going to try and do. And, you know, also there's a saying that if you don't have anything to say, please don't say it aloud, you know, so I try and keep that in mind. You know, that's a deal for me, too, because I feel like I'm up here, so I need to fill the void. You know, there can't be a void. And, you know, and I'm the talker in my family. You know, that's just all there is to it. And I'm the fast talker in my family. And, you know, my husband jokes that part of the reason that I talk as fast as I do is I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out, you know, to tell him everything it was, you know, because he was going to hear it. And that's pretty much, you know, the way it is for me. But when I do talk about Al-Anon in the program, you know, I'm excited. I get excited about it. You know, I have that enthusiasm for being here. And I'm so grateful that I walked into a group that was enthusiastic to begin with. You know, a lot of times, you know, I get to go to other states and conferences and things like that. And, you know, and sometimes Al-Anon's really like the secondary thing. I mean, you know, it's all about Alcoholics Anonymous. Big banners, Alcoholics Anonymous Convention, you know, and then a little tiny print with Al-Anon participation, you know, and that always pisses me off. And, you know, because I'm not secondary, you know. That's one thing I've learned in my group. You know, my program is just as important to me as the, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, is to the alcoholic. And that's my responsibility. That's my responsibility. I'm the one that's supposed to make sure, you know, that I keep my program out there and foremost. And, you know, when I always joke about Al-Anon participation with the AAs, you know, when they say that at conferences, and, you know, I always go, oh, yeah, just with Al-Anon participation at the conference, I go, boy, when you're in jail, you want Al-Anon participation then, don't you? Yeah, let's call the Al-Anons. You know, we're really big on their participation, so... But anyway, it's a really important thing to me. I get about as excited as Al-Anon as I did, you know, when the alcoholic pulls in the driveway. You know, my heart starts beating, you know, and I just, that same adrenaline rush starts going on. And, you know, and my sponsors really found a saying, you know, if you pay as much attention to your program as you gave one iota of their drinking, you know, you're bound to be a success here. You know, and I absolutely positively believe that. And again, it's just taking all that negative energy and turning it around to a positive energy. You know, again, things that I've learned from you guys. You know, I didn't want to, when I walked into Al-Anon, I did not want to be here. It was not a place that I wanted to be sitting at, and I absolutely didn't really want much to do with any of it. I didn't like the name. I think the name's pathetic. It just doesn't even sound like there's any, you know, I think it should be kicked but anonymous, you know, or something like that. You know, I want something with some punch to it, you know. And then when I was reading the early days when they were talking about, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous Auxiliary, that could have been our name. You know, it could have been much worse. It could have been much worse. So it's a wonderful place to be. And I love to be here, and I'm just as enthusiastic about Al-Anon, and I hope that you are too. And obviously you are, because you get up and you give up your Saturday to come here, and that's really what it's all about, participating in our own recovery. You know, and another thing is, you know, as I stand up before you today, you know, I'm no authority. I am absolutely no authority on how this program works. You know, I don't know that anybody's an authority on it. Everybody just shares their experience, strength, and hope to the best of their ability, you know, and that's all that I really have to give to you. You know, everyone's an example. Some people are a bad example. You know, I hear some people say some stuff from the podium, and it's just like, thank you for sharing, but that's not how I want to be. You know, and other people just give me nothing but hope, you know, to go on. So, you know, and I learn from that. I learn from how I want to be, and I learn how I don't want to be from going to meetings, and that's really important for me. And the other thing, take what you like and leave the rest. You know, that's, again, you know, there's things that, you know, I've heard shared that I don't understand, or that maybe I just can't digest that day. That's what growth way beyond my capacity at this particular time. And it doesn't mean you have to go home and do it. It just, you know, I'm not there right now. Take what you like and leave the rest. Take what works for you. And if it doesn't work for you, just leave it there. You don't have to. There are no shoulds or haves to in Al-Anon, which is another thing why I really love this program. You know, I shared last night, you know, I grew up in this military house, and there was so much have to, rules and regulations and all that. And that's one of the things that I absolutely love about being here. There really are no, they're suggested steps, and we really do suggest you take them, you know, if you want to get well here. But at the same token, you know, take what you like and leave the rest. Do what you need to do, but keep coming. You know, and I see people drive themselves out because they try too hard, or they don't think it's making sense for them, or it's not working for them because it's just not coming as fast as you would like it to come. You know, I'm that way. You know, it's just like, as soon as I know that there's an answer, you know, I want to go there right now. I want to be fixed right now. When my husband was drinking, I used to love to go to bookstores and read about books about, you know, go to the bookstores and take out books about alcoholism. Now, I never read the front of the books, because I already know the front. I always turn to the last page, because I want to know the cure. You know, I don't want to know how you get there. I just want to be there. And again, I've learned, you know, it's a process. Nobody just gets to be there. If there was a magic wand and we could touch you, you know, wouldn't we do it in a second? I mean, wouldn't we absolutely positively do it in a second? But that's not the way that it works here. It's just not the way that it works. So, and again, I can only share my experience, strength, and hope. And Al-Anon has taught me, I can't give you something I don't have. You know, I can't share an experience with you that is not mine to share. But, you know, I've learned in Al-Anon, too, that, you know, especially for people I've sponsored, if they've had a particular incident happen in their life, and, you know, and that has not been my experience, you know, the fact is that more than likely, because I've been coming for a while, I know somebody who has that experience. You know, so I'll say, you know, call Judy, or, you know, call Bob. You know, I know that they've been through that. You need to talk with them. You know, that's not something that I have to give to you. And that's a really great relief too. You know, that it's not my burden to carry for everybody, and I'm glad to know that. You know, and I can't do it for you. I wish I could. You know, there's people I sponsor, boy, I wish I could do it for them. You know, but everybody gets here at their own weight and pace. You got to do it your own way. And I know you don't get Al-Anon by osmosis. You know, that would be great if that happened that way, too. But, you know, Al-Anon's an action program, and you learn by doing here. You just have to, you know, you have to get out there. You have to take a chance. You have to put it out there and take a risk, you know, and trying something different. That's the hardest thing in the world for me is doing something different. You know, I just like, you know, it's just like someone says, you know, it's like staying in your own shit, you know. It's not really where you want to be, but it's warm. And you know what it smells like, and you know what it feels like, you know. And so, and that's the deal for me. Because the deal is it might be worse. If I go there, it might be worse. So I'm just going to stick it out here. And again, it's just taking that chance, taking that risk. Believing, you know, what other people share with me at the meeting. You know, that they made an attempt to do something different, and it changed for them. You know, and it wasn't because I was so brave on my own to go and do that. It's because I really believed what you told me. And that's what gave me the courage to go out and do it. You know, and everything I share with you today is just my opinion. And I really do believe that opinions are like assholes. Everyone has one. And that's just the way that it goes, you know. And that's, again, the things that I got taught here. Because I think, you know, when you get to talk from the podium, you know, some people give the person talking from the podium a lot of power. And they say, you know, and again, they share their experience, strength, and hope. But the bottom line is that unless it's in the literature, you know, it's not, you know, it's that person's opinion. And that's the bottom line. And because, you know, I think when I'm up here sometimes I have to remember that, you know, just because I'm saying it, again, you're just hearing my opinion. What Larsine thinks this particular day, you know, June the 28th, you know, in Indianapolis, Indiana. Now come talk to Larsine next week, you know, in Hawthorne, California, in her bathroom, you know, and we may be on a totally different page. You know, I'm just sharing you what you know, my opinion is today. And whatever I share with you, you know, those are my particular beliefs. You know, what I'm sharing with you today is what I believe to be true today. You know, and I could have picked it up in the Al-Anon literature at my Al-Anon meeting. I could have picked it up at an AA meeting. I could have picked it up out of a fortune cookie. You know, and that's why I say, you know, you just kind of have to just take what you like and leave the rest. Because I believe God talks to me through all kinds of media, all kinds of different ways, and that's what my program is really based on for me, is how my God talks to me. Because I do. I get up every morning, I get on my knees, and I turn my will and my life over to the care of God. You know, it's another thing my sponsor taught me, too. You know, the best way to get back up on your feet, you know, is to start on your knees. And that's what I try and do every day, and talk to my God and ask him to show me the way to go. And believe you me, we were talking this morning. We were talking a lot this morning. So, you know, and then why I picked experience, strength, and hope when I was talking with Joyce, and she says, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, you know, I wanted to leave it. You know, just like when I pick a sponsor, I want to leave it wide open. You know, so experience, strength, and hope for me just covers everything you could possibly cover in Al-Anon. And experience, strength, and hope for me is the deal. You know, I talked to my sponsor and others who have done this before me. And why do I talk to others who have done this before me? Because I haven't done it before. You know, the best way to get any kind of experience, strength, and hope is to talk to people who have walked the path. You know, and so, you know, my sponsor's done this a couple of times, and I know, you know, other people that have done it, and I know people that are really good at it. They are just remarkable. It just blows my mind how they can sit up here and, you know, and just pick out these just wonderful things that I have totally never seen before. So, you know, and it shouldn't be so hard for me. You know, my husband says I can talk for 5 hours about my big toe, and Lord knows I can talk to the alcoholic for days on end. But again, you know, the bottom line for me is I want to do well by Al-Anon. You know, that's the whole thing. I want to do well by Al-Anon. And their experience, let me see. I want to stick here because I did have something here I wanted to mention that my sponsor had told me. Their experience for me was to share on what I know. They said, don't say anything you don't know, Larsine. Please don't say it out loud. Okay, so I'm going to try. And their strength was that they said I had a good and solid program, and that's what I should bring and share with you, you know, and that I look to my higher power for guidance. And their hope for me was that I didn't muck it up, you know, so, and make my group look bad, you know, so, and, you know, and another thing, any of the good stuff that I share with you today, anything good that you hear come out of this mouth didn't originate in this brain. It absolutely, positively did not. Anything good that I have has come from going to meetings, you know, from stuff that I've read in the literature, you know, from things that you have shared with me. I have never had an original good thought in my life. You know, I have negative thoughts. That's where my thoughts come from. So I don't want to take credit for any of the good stuff you hear. That's the stuff that you guys have shared with me. That's what you've given me. You know, and you know, in all good conferences, I read this one time, it says good conferences are like orgies. You know, when it's all over, you never know who made you feel good. You know, and that's really what it is. So, you know, when I say good things, I may not be able to exactly tell you who it was that told me that. You know, because again, I can't remember who it was exactly that made me feel good about that. But the fact that they said it and it stuck here, you know, had an impact on me, you know, and that's the deal for me. You know, so I was going to kind of, you know, break this like up into three parts, and part one was going to be, you know, experience, strength, and hope. Part one is what it was like, and that was my experience. And, you know, and you guys got to hear a lot of, you know, my stuff last night if you were here, and, you know, and how it was for me. And, you know, and I don't know who here in this group, you know, was a little kid and thought, boy, I can't wait till I get to go to Al-Anon. You know, if you're like, you know, any other, you know, normal little kid or something, you know, I was dreaming of Prince Charming and being rescued and taken off. You know, I didn't add that little twist, well, I hope my Prince Charming drinks like a pig, you know, and never goes to work. You know, that wasn't part of my fantasy, but, you know, I had no idea that that would bring me here either, you know, and give me this way of life, you know, which is absolutely just phenomenal to me, just phenomenal to me. You know, and growing up, you know, as a child in an alcoholic home, again, how do you know? You know, how do you have any idea that how this is all going to affect you and, you know, and the path of life you're going to take because of it? We were talking this morning at breakfast, you know, growing up in an alcoholic home, growing not up, and, you know, people have alcoholic parents, you know, people are in Al-Anon that don't have alcoholic parents. People are in Alcoholics Anonymous that grew up in terribly dysfunctional homes, and people are in Alcoholics Anonymous that grew up in the best homes in the entire world. You know, I don't know what's, you know, makes these things happen or don't happen. You know, it, generally for me, life is just plain old life. It just kind of turns out the way that it turns out. I think we're all born with, you know, just, you know, certain personality traits that are just there, that are just positively there. I was watching this one thing on Discovery Channel or whatever, and they were showing these little children. They were showing them in a room, and they were like about, you know, little toddlers, 2, 3, 4-year-old children. And how, and just, there's maybe 20 of them, and they put them all in a room together, and the high-maintenance kids, the kids that just are not happy, that just sit there and sob and cry, and nothing makes them happy. And then there's the other little kids, and these are 2- and 3-year-old children that are walking over trying to console the crying kids, you know, trying to give them toys and make them happy. That I call the Al-Anon. The pre-Al-Anon group is here. You know, right away, we're, you know, even though there are all these toys for us to play with, you know, we are focused on the people who are not happy. And, you know, and I believe that that's in my DNA. I just think that that's just in my personality and the way that I am. I am that way. We were joking last, well, this couple right over here was leaving last night, and they were trying to find their car. Now, they didn't ask me to help them find their car, but they were distressed, so I made it my mission to walk with them down the hallway, show them where I saw the parking lot from the window of my room, and then ask them if they were okay, and I could go back to my room now. And, you know, and again, this is, I'm that way at the airport. If I see someone having a hard time, I'll get up from my chair and go over and, you know, and offer my assistance. And, you know, and is it because I'm so loving and kind, or is it because I can't mind my own business? You know, I mean, there's a real thing in there, you know, you have to try and find. And these are all things I just developed as a child. You know, I think being firstborn had a lot to do with it, you know? I mean, it's, again, I felt a lot of responsibility and obligation that was placed upon me, whether or not it was placed upon me or not. I don't remember my mother ever standing before me saying, now you need to be in charge, and you're the oldest, and blah, blah, blah. But I just naturally took that on. That's just my deal. That's just the way, that's just my personality. You know, and part of Al-Anon has becoming accepting to accept my personality. This is who I am. You know, I'm a yakker and a talker, and sometimes I get to talking and going off so fast, boy, I think things come out of my mouth I haven't even thought of yet, you know, which is, you know, words I would like to suck back, but, you know, I mean, I'm just, because again, I'm filling the void, and a lot of times I talk fast and get blurred because I'm uncomfortable, and so this is my personality. This is how I compensate. And one time I remember we were at a party, and I was talking and maybe being a little loud or whatever in the corner, and I remember my husband coming over to me and squeezing me on the elbow, telling me that I was being loud and that he didn't like it. And I immediately was embarrassed, just immediately embarrassed, very uncomfortable, and humiliated for myself. And you know, and then I got to think about it and pray about it a little bit, you know, and I got to talk to my husband about it the next day. And I got to tell my husband, you know, I'm sorry if that made you uncomfortable, but you know what? You're married to a loud, obnoxious, you know, woman that talks a lot. I don't know if you've noticed it yet, you know, but, you know, that's my personality, you know, and if that makes you uncomfortable, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be not who I am. you know, to make you be comfortable with it. You know, and that's what that's courage and things that I get from Al-Anon. That's the stuff that it got. It's not that he's wrong for how he feels about it, but he has to deal with how he feels about it. I don't have to deal with how he feels about it. You know, and there's another thing, too, you know. I mean, I'm not saying that that gives you carte blanche for just, you know, so if your personality is a butthole, you know, that you should walk around and, well, I'm sorry, I'm a butthole naturally, and therefore, you know, you'll have to. But the deal is you want to improve yourself where you can, but you need to be who you are, too. You know, to your own self be true. You know, that's one of the things that I got to learn here. But coming into Al-Anon, I was so many things for so many people all the time. It was people-pleasing. Was just, that was the role that I was just bred to have. You know, I want to make everybody be happy. You know, it's the same thing the little kids in the room. 99 people can be happy, but I will focus in on the person who's not having a good time here. You know, and I got to turn away from that. You know, I got to say, you know, do you need some help? Do you want to talk to somebody? You know, I can give them options, but then my job is done. You know, that's, it's up to them to make a step forward and do whatever. And, you know, and again, you know, how we're all affected by it. And I remember being the first time that I felt like that there was something wrong in my family, or the first time that I really felt that there was something wrong with me, that I started taking on that responsibility for the disease of alcoholism in my home. And I remember we were changing duty stations, and my dad, we were living in Ohio, and we were moving to Chicago. And we had a little lull there, so my mom's whole family lived out in California. And so my dad sent my mom and my sisters and my brother out to California for 2 weeks while he stayed here and secured our new living quarters. And we went out to California for 2 weeks, and we stayed with my aunt and my uncle, and they're fairly well-off people. They live in Pacific Palisades, which is a very, you know, really nice residential area, you know, the big backyard, the big pool, you know, and I was, oh, probably 8 years old. And so, of course, we come to California, and they did all the stuff with us. They took us to Disneyland. You know, every day was a party and barbecues. But what I noticed the most about being with them was watching my uncle with my cousins, you know, how he sat down to dinner with them. He tickled them, you know, he kind of did this dad kind of stuff that I was not used to seeing. And so subsequently, after we come back from that 2 weeks, you know, and I remember our plane landing in Chicago, and I knew that my dad was down there, and he hadn't seen us for 2 weeks, and I know he'd be looking for a big old hug and all this stuff. And I remember feeling that pit in the bottom of my stomach, you know, that I didn't want to get off that airplane. I didn't want to go give my dad a big old hug. And the thought that went through my head wasn't that there's, what's the matter with my family? Is there a problem here? The thought that went through my head is there's something wrong with you. Because if you're a good little girl and you're the good daughter, you know, then you should be wanting to go hug your dad. You know, and again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know it. Alcoholism, the family disease. You know, and right away, you know, these missed thoughts, you know, start triggering in my head, become fact for me. This is it, so there's something wrong with me. You know, and that's what starts the compensating part now. And, you know, it's like I have to overachieve. And then how we were all affected in my family by the disease of alcoholism. You know, how I was affected, you know, again, the people-pleasing, the taking responsibility, the being the overachiever. Always straight A's in school. You know, always on the honor list. Always doing those kinds of things. Because I learned early on, too, I am not stupid. You keep your nose clean. Stay out of trouble, you know. You walk the rule and regulation line. You know, because when you don't, boy, the Sarge is all over you. And it's bad enough when the Sarge is all over you when you're walking the line, but when you don't walk the line, you're really going to eat it big time. And I know this because I watched my sisters, you know, they took a lot more punishment from my dad than I ever did because they just weren't that way. My sister's reaction to, you know, the disease of alcoholism were totally different. My sister, who's just 13 months behind me, where I was the good girl, the good student, you know, the overachiever, she was just completely the opposite. You know, at 14, she's a chronic runaway from home. You know, and doing all those kinds of things and ditching school and just, you know, just with the complete opposite direction that I did. You know, and I remember her one time being in juvenile hall and sitting there with my dad while they brought her out, you know, and stuff, and we were in this little juvenile hall court thing about, you know, whether she was going to come home or go back to detention. And I remember my sister standing up there and the judge talking to her and her saying that she wanted to go back to juvenile hall rather than go back to our house. You know, and I remember sitting there, the good little daughter, thinking, boy, I wish I could go with her. You know, because that's just, if you grow up in an alcoholic home, you know, and it's that kind of stuff that's going on, juvenile hall looks better. You know, again, you know, and it's just the disease of alcoholism. It's just the way that it goes. Then I have another sister, you know, who's about 4 years younger than me, and she was I call her Fantasy Barbie, and because that's just her. It was just dolls. Everything is just pretend, and even pretty much today, you know, I love her to pieces, and she's a wonderful sister, but. But it's just fantasy Barbie. It's just like pretend. My sister's cure for the homeless people is that everyone should put a tent in their backyard and take in a homeless family. I mean, you know, she's always got all these fix-it kind of schemes going on, and but it's fantasy Barbie land, and everything will be wonderful. And again, how we're all affected, you know, how our family and, you know, outside of our family and friends, you know, we didn't have many friends. It's not that I didn't have friends at school. I did, but if you've ever had a drunken dad show up at a school function, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is just not reserved for the alcoholic. You know, so you quit having friends come home, you know, to that situation. It's just too painful. You just, you know, quit doing those things. And, you know, and those are just some of the dynamics of my experience in growing up, you know. But I also know that there were positive experiences. You know, I always felt loved by my dad. And I always felt loved by my mom to the best that they were able to give it in that situation. I never felt like we were really deprived. You know, I don't feel like I didn't have a family. You know, I was close to my sisters and, you know, and my brother and my mom and my dad in certain ways. You know, but what I've learned in Al-Anon, too, is that, you know, part of my misconception, again, is always growing up is watching other people, watching television. This is what the perfect family is supposed to be like. You leave it to Beaver, you know, and Father Knows Best and all those kinds of things. Things that I grew up with. But in reality, I know that my dad, you know, when he wasn't drinking, you know, was a loving dad as he was capable of being. And what I've learned is that it doesn't always come in the package that I think it's supposed to come in. And because it doesn't come in the bright package with the big red bow, then that means that it's not there, not true. Sometimes, you know, love comes in a cardboard box. And you wouldn't even think to look in there, in a beat-up cardboard box to begin with. You know, but you have to be willing to look in the different places. You know, it just doesn't always come the way you think it's packaged. So don't miss that gift just because it's not wrapped up that way. You know, but the bottom line for me is that my family was fear-based. Our family was fear-based. Just, and that's just, in alcoholism, boy, fear is the big thing. Fear is just the big thing. And for me, all the negative emotions, you know, that I've learned in the disease of alcoholism are just fear-based. That's really where it all comes from for me. And it's the very first emotion I even remember having. I remember being 2 or 3 years old and hearing my parents yelling and fear. That was the very first thing I ever remember feeling in my family. You know, what was that? And I know it was because of alcoholism. And when you're fearful, you know, sometimes you got to pay attention to that because it's for good reason. You know, sometimes there is crap to be afraid of, and you should pay attention. But that's where the physical violence and the emotional violence and just all that stuff started to happen for me. And I got real big after I was in Al-Anon for a while. I loved to go to meetings, and people would say, well, you know what, fear, you know, I looked up this in the dictionary, and I looked up that in the dictionary, you know. And see, I never had time to look up things in the dictionary. When you're married to an alcoholic, who has time to read? You know, I'm sorry. You just don't have time for any of that stuff. And I always thought it was dumb when people would say that they did that. You know, but now I know why you look up words in the dictionary. Because I didn't read or look up words in the dictionary, that meant that I made up my definition for what words meant. You know, what does this mean to me? It's not the actual meaning, it's what it means to me. So I looked up the definition of fear, and in the library it says, fear is an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation or awareness of danger and implies anxiety and usually loss of courage. So that made me look up courage. You know, and the definition of courage is mental or moral strength to venture, persevere, and withstand danger, fear, or difficulty implies firmness of mind and will in the face of danger or extreme difficulty. See, and the first thing that got robbed from me was courage. You know, was just the ability. Those times when you know you're right. You know, and it's not even so much hanging on to the right to be right, but knowing that you're doing the right thing. And then letting yourself get back down because I was afraid to stand up for it. You know, I remember my dad one time being very physical with my mom, and I was getting bigger then, about 12 or 13 years old, and I ran into the living room and I told my dad, don't you dare hit my mom, and then he turned around to hit me, you know, which scared me, made me fearful, and I ran away. And then I remember my dad saying to my mom, see, even your children won't defend you. You know, and again, you know, it's just these are just the things that we learn, you know, and therefore that I thought that I was bad because I didn't defend my mom, when in reality I knew the best that I was able to do. Now as an adult I can look back there and go, as a 13-year-old kid, boy, I did pretty darn good, you know, but at the time I was made to feel bad for doing the right thing. But that's the disease of alcoholism. That doesn't even really have anything to do with my dad. You know, the disease of alcoholism has to make you think you're doing bad all the time. That's just the way that it works. And, you know, my favorite definition of courage today is what I learned in Al-Anon, is courage is fear that said its prayers. That's really the bottom line. You know, courage is no big deal if you're not afraid to do it. You know, if you are not afraid to jump out of an airplane, then you, what kind of courage does it take, you know? But if you're petrified, but in the back of your mind, this is a dream you've always wanted to do, you know, that's the deal. You just say your prayers. God, show me the way to go. You know, and that's how it's always worked for me. I'm fearful of all kinds of stuff, and that's what I've just learned to do. I've just learned to say my prayers. I'm petrified to get up before you guys today and do this workshop, you know, but I know that God's with me. You know, I turned it over, and I'm going to do the very best that I can, and that's the bottom line, you know, because the other ultimate thing for me to do is just to get in a cab and go to the airport. Now, granted, you guys will be talking about me for a while, you know, and whatever, but, you know, I don't live here, so what do I care, you know? I mean, you know, so what? I don't ever plan on coming back to Indianapolis again. The whole entire state will be X'd out, you know, a circle with an X through it. You know, that's how I handle, you know, we just won't ever go there ever, ever again. And, you know, but the bottom line is I say my prayers and I walk through my fear, you know, and here I'm standing with you and it's just the way it's going to go and you can have a good time and maybe you'll get something and maybe you won't. And it's not about any of that. It's just about standing up, you know, and walking through the fear. But anyway, fear is what started the downward spiral for me, you know, especially when I got involved with my own alcoholic, because fear led me to expectations. And expectations are what led me to resentment and blame. And then that led me to guilt and martyrdom. And that led me to self-righteousness. And that takes me to hatred and anger. And that's a huge price to pay, you know, but I paid that price willingly every day for it, you know, because I masked all those other character defects with denial, you know, to me, you know, and that's like the Al-Anon, these are the things that get you here. You know, this is the way that the disease of alcoholism progresses in me, you know, and I'm not the person that's drinking. These are all the emotions that I take on, you know, and it's manipulation and control and all these things, these expectations, resentments, blame, you know, that used to be my toolbox. That's where I went in to get my tools to fix these things, you know. That's what I thought would fix my problems when those were my problems. I was using my problems to try and fix my problems. And expectations, you know, I read expectations as premeditated resentment. You know, and that's pretty much, you know, that's been my whole life. You know, what I expected when I got married, you know, I expected we were going to be like Ozzy and Harriet. I mean, that is really what I expected when we got married. And the only way Butch was like Ozzy was you didn't know what he did for a living either. Because, I mean, he was like this. Total non-functioning alcoholic. You know, I heard an AA share one time he was a functioning alcoholic because he had a wife who had a job. You know, and that's kind of how it was for us. You know, but I did. I had all these expectations about what our marriage was going to be like, this big dream that I made up in my mind. And no one could live up to that dream. You know, not only could Butch not live up to Ozzy, I could never live up to Harriet. You know, that is just because we're not Ozzy and we're not Harriet. We're Butch and we're Larcine. You know, and the things that work for Ozzy and Harriet might be fun to watch and work for them, but doesn't necessarily mean that it worked for us. You know, so from the very beginning that we got married, you know, I had a setup for failure because I had all these expectations about what I thought my husband should be and what I thought my husband should do. I was dependent on him for my happiness. That was his responsibility. That was his responsibility from the beginning. You know, and that was an unfair expectation to put on somebody, absolutely, positively. And so I doomed us from failure from the very beginning. You know, and what I got, you know, for my expectations, what did I get for all of that? The complete opposite. You know, I got a drunken marriage. I got the stuff that goes with drunken marriage. The money problems, you know, just all the stuff that just goes with it. The anger, the resentment, the frustration, and that's just this giant snowball that just starts growing and growing and growing and growing. You know, and then when all these problems started happening, then I got this expectation that if I love him enough, that'll fix it. Because somewhere in my head, I've got the expectation that love fix everything, you know. And what I know today is that, you know, if loving alcoholics would fix them, none of us would be in this room today. We wouldn't need Alcoholics Anonymous and we wouldn't need Al-Anon because there's no doubt about people being loved here. Before we ever get here, there's no doubt. You know, if you have a child that's out there using and abusing, I know how much you love that child and care about that child. If loving that child alone could fix the deal, you know, we wouldn't have the pain that we do. But there's a difference here, you know, because it's not just love. What we learned in Al-Anon, what I tried to share about last night, is the unconditional love, because there's the big difference. there's a big difference between love for me and unconditional love. And that's the stuff that I've learned here. You know, because what did I get for all my loving my husband? This outpouring of love and devotion, the sacrifices I made to try and fix him. You know, what did I get for all that? You know, I got nothing changed. Nothing changed at all. And why? Because my love was an unconditional love. You know, it had a huge price tag on it. You know, and it was the price tag of all the expectations I had. If I love you, you will. If I love you, you'll do this. You know, and when you put a price tag on something, then it's not a gift. You know, and it's not yours to take or have. You know, and again, I didn't know any of that stuff when I was doing it. But again, my expectations of what would come around if that was the way that we did things. And, you know, and what I expected from God. You know, I was not brought up religiously. We never went to church. We never baptized, none of that kind of stuff. I always had, you know, and it wasn't like my parents were atheists or anything else like that. I remember people talking about God, my mom talking about God. But we never had any kind of formal, you know, thing about God. You know, and I had huge, you know, again, my expectations of God. Because for whatever reason, this is what I got of God. If you are good, God will give you good things. And if you are bad, God will give you bad things. And that's the bottom line. And that's what I expected, and that's what I got. And because I kept getting bad things, no matter how hard I tried to be good, it was like, what's the point? You know, what's the point? You know, and then again, what I did get from God, but I didn't know all along, was lots of blessings. You know, all the time that I'm living with my husband, and we have all this misery going on in our home with alcoholism, never once did I stop to think that I had two healthy children. I always had a job. We always had money. I mean, as far as, you know, always had a roof over our head and food to eat. You know, always had, all those blessings were always provided for me. But because, again, the disease of alcoholism is so negative, I never see it. You know, I never see those good things that were there all the time. You know, and I believe that God answered my prayer so many times. He sent people into my life, I have no doubt about it. Opportunities into my life time and time again. I take it like God patting me on the shoulder. I would say these desperate, desperate prayers, and I believe they were answered. You know, but just because it wasn't in the box with the ribbon that I wanted it to be on, that therefore my prayers weren't answered. I think God tapped me on the shoulder lots of times, but I was like this. No, I don't want to do it that way. I don't want it to come that way. I don't want to hear it from that person. I want it to happen this way. You know, I think God is there all the time. And I think God's there for everybody. I don't think he's just there for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. I don't think we're just the chosen ones. You know, how come we get to be here and so many other families are out there suffering? How come some people get to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and others don't? Is somebody more deserving than someone else? You know, again, God's gift. It's just your willingness to accept the gift. If you don't accept the gift, it's not going to happen for you. And I think that God offered me the gift many, many times out there, but I wasn't taking it because it didn't come the way that I wanted it. I had all these expectations on how it's supposed to be. And that was the way I had to learn that lesson. You know, what I expected when my husband got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I expected him to do what I told him to do now. I mean, now he's not drunk, you know, and I expected all kinds of stuff to happen. I expected him to be very sorry, to want to make up forever and ever and ever all the terrible things that he put me through, and I expected to be fine. Bottom line, I expected to be fine, because I always said when Butch gets sober, you know, then I'm going to be just fine. When Butch is a good husband, I'm going to be just fine. When Butch is a good father, you know, when Butch goes to work every week and brings home a regular paycheck, I'm going to be just fine. You know, and here he was in Alcoholics Anonymous working the best program he knew how to work, going to work, being a good husband, being a good father, being all those wonderful things, you know, and I still wasn't okay because that didn't fix me. It just plain old didn't fix me. And, you know, and what I really got, you know, when my husband got sober is I got a sober husband working a program for himself. That's what I got. And again, you don't get it by osmosis. It just doesn't happen that way. Again, it would be nice. But again, you know, watching my husband get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous was a real attraction for me. It was absolutely, I am so grateful that my husband went to a group where, you know, where they told him to take his program home and work it at home. You know, and even though I was being difficult and argumentative and, you know, and being just disagreeable and a very hard person to live with, you know, he just kept bringing his program home and working his program. He didn't buy into the, you know, the negativity part anymore because he was learning a different way to go. He was working his program for himself the best that he could. Now, occasionally, he didn't often, but occasionally he would say to me, Larsine, you know, I think you should think about going to Al-Anon. You know, and I would, and remember one time we were having this conversation, and he's telling me how I should go to Al-Anon. And I remember telling him, you know what, dear? I have more maturity in this baby finger, you know, than if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of your life, you know. Because, again, this is my, you know, I am the saint. I am the one that's held it all together. Well, you know, I was in Al-Anon a little while before I found out, you know, this is where all my maturity is, right here in this baby finger. I wasn't too far off the mark, but... You know, but again, this huge ego, you know, and we think the alcoholic is the guy with the big ego, you know, and stuff. Well, I've been in Al-Anon enough to know, you know, that we suffer so much from, you know, the disease of alcoholism and then the Al-Anonism, if that's what you want to call it, really isn't that different. My husband says we should really call Al-Anon Xerox because we're just dry copies, you know, and it's, you know, I see a lot of truth in that. I just see a lot of truth in that. We are not really that different, but boy, sometimes we really want to be. And that's what happened, my expectation. You know, as his drinking gets worse, I became more saint-like. You know, that's just where I moved. You know, I just became more... I always say I would have made sainthood, but the SOB got sober on me. I was this close, you know, another week and I might have made it. You know, and again, because in my own head, how I justify my bad behavior is that I'm doing what I have to do because he's doing what he's doing. You know, and again, the stuff just takes you to a, you know, a terrible place. You know, what I expected when I first started coming to Al-Anon. I don't really know, to be honest with you, what I expected when I got here. I expected to be recognized for my sacrifices. You know, I expected that when we were at the meetings, we were all going to talk about all the crap that they did to us. You know, that's really what I expected to happen here. When I came to Al-Anon at first, boy, I love to hear the sick people talk. You know, they're so fun because they're talking about the stuff that I relate to. And that's why I really don't have too much trouble, you know, when people are new and they're sick here and they get up and they talk about the alcoholic. I think they need to do that. You know, but then they're going to hear the other people who have been here for a while talk about themselves and their recovery, because that's what I needed to hear. I mean, if you would have said, okay, Larson, this is what we do, and we never do this, and we never do that, or whatever, I'm so grateful I came into a group that said, we never, never. You know, we cut the newcomer lots of slack. Why? Because they're new. That's why. And don't ever forget what it was like to be new. To me, that's the most important thing. And I never really usually do. I mean, I am so comfortable in Al-Anon now, and I have steps to work and sponsors to call and a toolbox and things I can do and use. But boy, when a newcomer walks in the door and I see the pain in that person's eyes, I am there right now. I know exactly how they feel. I don't ever want to forget exactly how they feel. You know, so, you know, I can't say enough about how important it is to cut the newcomers some slack. And sometimes they got to spit garbage for a while. But that's when you get the opportunity, you know. Yeah, afterwards, you know, I felt like that too, but keep coming back. That's why when people spew garbage from the podium, that's what we say. Keep coming back. I wondered why I heard that so much in the beginning, you know. But thank God, you know, thank God I did. They didn't say, Larsine, that's garbage, that stinking thinking, you're full of crap or whatever. I had to let go of that stuff. And when I would spew the garbage, they'd pat me on the back. Your 3 minutes is up, keep coming back, and that would be the deal, and then I would be done. I would feel a little bit better, you know, because that's the path I had to go down to get here. And and like I said, that's what I expected when I started coming down. But what did I get? I got the truth. The truth is what you get here if you listen. If you take your head out of your ass and listen, you will hear the truth. And sometimes it's very painful. It was really painful for me in the beginning to have to acknowledge any kind of responsibility that I had for this ordeal. Very, very painful. And why? Because, you know, the truth is the light. The truth is the light, and alcoholism is the dark. You know, and I was in the dark. I was just in the dark for so long, and that's why the truth hurts. Because if you know as well as I, if you've been in a dark room and that first light comes in, the first thing you do is close your eyes. It hurts to look at it, so you don't look. You know, but then you start just a little bit, just peeking a little bit at a time. You know, and that's what happened to me. I got the truth. And the truth is the most important thing to me today. Absolutely, positively, the truth is just, you know, because alcoholism is living the lie. And I don't want to live the lie anymore. I just don't want to do that. Alcoholism wants me to. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, you can't be your whole life around the disease of alcoholism, I don't think. And you know, and that's why I say, even today, you know, there's the voice. There's the alcoholism voice, you know, the family disease of alcoholism voice that's always in my head. It's kind of like having, you know, sand poured in you. You know, it's like, it's all through your body. Alcoholism's just like all these granules of sand. And I keep coming to Al-Anon, and Al-Anon washes me. I have absolutely no doubt about that. You know, that it washes me clean and it continues to wash me clean, but it's never going to get every single grain of sand out of the deal. I am never going to be totally, fully recovered. I don't know what that is, and I don't know that that'll ever be my gift, but I strive towards that. I strive towards being as clean as I can be on any given day, and that's the deal for me. you know. And I was reading in the forum a couple of months ago, they had, you know, how everybody writes in their little articles and stuff like that. And usually, to be honest with you, I don't much care for the forum. I think the stories are, you know, mamsy-pamsy Al-Anon, little weenie stories, you know. You know, I want the kick-butt Al-Anon stories in there, you know, and stuff. I don't want the little, you know, and then I saw the light and everything's better. You know, I just want to know, it was hard and I had to kick butt, and, you know, and my sponsor and da-da-da-da-da-da. But I get the forum and I read it because I'm willing, because every so often I run across a jewel in there. And a couple of months ago, one of the little articles that somebody wrote there, they talked about the gift of diminished expectations, you know, and for whatever reason that day, that just hit me like just a big old ton of bricks, because that is a gift, you know. When I put upon you the gift of diminished, you know, I just, you know, expect you to be as good as a person today as you know how to be. That's my only expectation of everybody, you know, and hopefully you're able to fulfill that. But again, that's your responsibility, not mine. You know, if I strive every day to be the best person I know how to be, why can't I give you credit for the same thing? You know, and that's, again, one more time what I've learned here. I'm fully willing to give myself credit for it, how hard I'm working, how hard I'm trying. You know, but boy, I see you just move a little bit off the path there, and I'm just, okay, get back in line over here. You know, and none of my business. How do I know that's not the best that you can do? On my absolutely positive worst days in Al-Anon, you know, and I go to bed at night, and I think about, boy, this day was just sucked. I mean, there's no better way to describe it. But then I think about, how would this day be if I didn't have a program? You know, and that's the bottom line. If it sucked because I had a program, I can't even imagine. I'd be suicidal. You know, and one more time, you know, being here is absolutely no guarantee, you know, but some days are just rough. Some days are just hard. But I don't have to do it alone if I don't want to do it alone. You know, and then, like I say, all these expectations, then that led me into resentments and blame. You know, that's where I'm at next. And, you know, and blame, my favorite defect of character. I just love blame because it gets me off the hook for everything. You know, when I'm blaming you, it's your fault. And that's cool with me, you know, because then it's your fault. And if you're married to an alcoholic, you got a built-in excuse for everything, you know. You know how, what was that movie they used to have, you know, I'm thinking of that one with Ally McGraw, and she was dying, and love story. Love is never having to say you're sorry. Being married to an alcoholic is never having to say you're sorry. You know, that's I mean, because it's always their fault. I mean, no matter what goes wrong. And it didn't matter. My husband could be gone, and my son could fall down and hit his head, and I would make it be my husband's fault. Because, see, he wasn't home, and so I wasn't paying attention to them because I was over here worrying about him. You know, it's just the chain that goes on that makes it be your fault. You know, and another great side effect of blame means I also get to decide your punishment. You know, if it's your fault, I get to decide how you will be punished. And, you know, and it's in the big bed, out of the big bed, you know. And, you know, all those kinds of things that we think of, you know, sex is a huge deal. I mean, it's a huge punishment tool. And, you know, just whatever things that I think that he wants that I can have any kind of finger of control over. You know, and who says I get to decide who gets to be punished or how they get to be punished? Who put that ball in my court? And again, you know, stuff that I, you know, decided would be my responsibility, you know, that I get to decide, you know, and then blaming God, you know, that was a big deal for me because there's no defense against that. You know, like I shared last night, if God's punishing you, you know, again, you got no defense against that. You might as well just roll on over, you know, but I don't believe in a God that does those kinds of things anymore, you know, and that's because of you, you know. And, you know, and what difference does establishing blame make? Will establishing blame change anything? Does it ever change anything? When you know whose fault it is, does that make the car accident go away? You know, does that make anything go away? But for me, it was really important. It's really important that we identify whose fault it is. You know, even though it never changed one iota of anything. And I would spend forever and ever going over all the blame, forever and ever going over all the punishment. I would just, you know, pace back and forth at night while he was out drinking and come up with these giant, you know, eloquent speeches, you know, about how I was going to say this and how I was going to say that. And then, you know, it would be this profound thing and, oh, this will shock him and this will, you know, do this. I used to plot my own suicide all the time. You know, I always used to, and then I would have, and I would practice laying in the living room, you know, how he would find my body. And, but, you know, there's only one thing about killing yourself when you're married to an alcoholic, is you cannot rely on him to find your body, you know. And, I mean, if I could have relied on that, I might have done it. But, you know, he may not come home for 3 days or 4 days or 5 days. You may be buried before he ever even knows you're gone, you know. So, you know, you just, it doesn't work, you know. It just plain old doesn't work. If that would have worked, I would have done it in a heartbeat, you know. And that's what it would have worked for me, you know. And blame for me leads right into resentment. You know, I blamed him for so long, for so many things. I pointed out all the errors of his ways and, you know, and punished him at will. My husband was an easygoing guy. We never had violence in my house. He never hit me, never tried to hit me. You know, he wasn't a yeller or a screamer. Those were all my character defects. Those were all the things I brought to the party. And, you know, and I'm so many times, you know, in watching him be so remorseful and so sorry, you know, and I could look in his eyes, you know, and know how sorry he was, you know, for, you know, his transgressions the day before, or whatever had happened, and not be able to stop it, not be able to stop just that haranguing that I just had to just keep going, keep the heat on, because I think that's my solution. Again, I'm looking to problems to fix problems, and it just gets worse and worse, and, you know, and resentment is a horrible thing. You know, resentment is like taking poison and expecting the other person to die. You know, and that's the deal. You know, I heard that in Al-Anon, and boy, I just thought, isn't that the truth? You know, I was so full of resentments when I got here. Just so full of resentments. I wouldn't know a gratitude or a grateful if it bit me on the butt. I mean, that's just how focused I was on how resentful I was at the world and everything and everybody. Feeling sorry for yourself is pathetic. It's just the most pathetic thing. And again, you know, as the non-drinkers, that's how I was affected. You know, just the giant pity pot, just the woe is me. You know, watching the news and terrible things happening, people starving or being flooded out of their homes in India. And I had absolutely no compassion for those people. I could have cared less, you know, because it was all about me and all about, you know, how crappy my life was, you know. And when you get so focused and your vision is so narrow, you don't see anybody else. That's why service is so important, being of service to your fellow man, taking the focus off of you and looking at what I can do to help other people. You know, that's where there's just so much healing in that type of stuff. But boy, the focus on me all the time was just absolutely, I was so resentful. My first sponsor, Jeannie, was huge on gratitude. Oh, attitude of gratitude. That's all she would ever say to me. You need an attitude of gratitude. And no matter what was going on in my life, she would find a reason for me to be grateful. You know, I would, no, I don't care what garbage I would spew on her. She would pick out the gratitude in there and tell me to focus on that. And one day, I'm at this point, you know, I'm new in Al-Anon. I have a husband and two boys. Living in my home, I don't have to tell you what my toilet looks like with two little boys and an alcoholic husband. And it's just not a pleasant place to go. And as the only female in the house, you know, we got the lid thing going on all the time as well. So one morning I'm there and I'm doing my household chores and I'm cleaning the toilet. And I become very resentful of this. This is crap. You know, why do I have to clean up this stuff of other people? You know, not that I'm the housewife or this is my job or this is what I have taken on as my responsibility. I make it be a big old resentment. So I decide to call Jeannie and tell her about my toilet issue. You know, let's see what's to be grateful about the resenting the toilet thing. And so I tell Jeannie what I'm doing and, you know, and how resentful I am about this and that I have to clean up this crap or whatever. And Jeannie, without missing a beat, she says to me, "You should be grateful, you know, that everybody in your house has a healthy penis." You know, I mean, it was just like that. And now, I don't tell that story so I can say penis from the podium, even though it is kind of fun. But, you know, that's when I said to her, "What's the deal? You know, what is the deal with this, you know, this, you know, that I can be grateful that they have healthy penises, you know, when, what does that have to do with cleaning the toilet?" And she says, it has to do with everything. She goes, "Larsine, you are one of the luckiest people I know. Your husband's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You have two healthy children. You know, you've got this great family going for you. You have, you know, you got a roof over your head. You have food to eat. You have a job. You're going to Al-Anon. You have lots of friends, family that care and love you. And you constantly want to look at what's to be resentful about. What's bad about my life?" And what she told me that day is, "I'm here to tell you that you cannot be grateful and resentful at the same time. So if you stop your resentment and look at the gratitude that's what's going on in your life, then the resentment will go away." Well, of course, I'm stubborn as I know how to be anyway, so I spent the whole day trying to be grateful and resentful at the same time all day long. You know, I would just get myself all worked up over resentment, then find the gratitude, see if I could keep the resentment going. And Grant, I can be resentful and I can be grateful, but I cannot be both at the same time. You know, and that's just like this, the valuable lessons you get from sponsors. I mean, it's not a lesson I wanted. It's not anything that I wanted to learn or that I thought I wanted to learn. But that's just how it's been for me, you know, no matter what's going on in my life. You know, no matter how scary it is or what the deal is, if you look for what's to be grateful in there, If you and you know, people die. That's a horrible thing, you know. But for me, you know, when people have died in my life, you know, the gratitude has been that I haven't had to do it by myself. You know, I've had friends that have walked through the whole deal with me. I'm never grateful that people are gone, but I'm grateful for the people that God puts in my life to help me get through those particular situations. You know, and then all that resentment, now I'm with guilt and martyrdom. You know, oh boy, I love guilt and I love martyrdom. Irma Bombeck, guilt, the gift that keeps on giving. And I think about that, because I think about that when people try and put the guilt on me and they try and make me feel bad for something I've said or I've done by the way that they impose their things. And boy, when you're married to an alcoholic, at least for me, oh, I'm good at it. I am really good at it. And I used to think I was just so innocent, just so innocent. And people make the mistake of... you know, they mistake a short memory for a clear conscience. You know, and I try and remember that because I just remember the bits and pieces that I want to remember, you know, to try and keep my thing. And I've learned in Alan on pretty much the truth. When I am honest and I am truthful, when I am on that level with myself that day, if I feel guilty about something, then I usually am. Then that means I got to take a look at it because I've done something or said something that was out of line. Because when I do, my first thing is to justify it. You know, I did this because, and that's why that makes it okay. And when I find myself on the justifying road, you know, then I know I got to go back and look at it. I'm not being honest anymore. I'm starting to cover it up with all that garbage again, so I don't have to look at my part. And my part's the only thing I can do something about. You know, I love in understanding ourselves. It says perhaps the most severe damage to those of us who have shared some part of life with an alcoholic comes in the form of the nagging belief that we are somehow at fault. We were not on top of it all, not attractive enough, not clever enough to have solved this problem for the one we love. We think it was something we did or did not do, and these are our feelings of guilt. You know, and in the ways, you know, that I tried to be clever enough and attractive enough, you know, to fix it for my husband, you know, they're just countless. I mean, I tried everything there was in the world to fix him. You know, and I thought it was my responsibility to do that because I was his wife. I'm the one that's supposed to do it. And in the Courage to Change, there's a page in there that just talks about manipulation, and I love that page. You know, and the whole deal, one more time, about how I try and make him, how I try and set up situations. If I know we're going to go somewhere, make it so I'm with him all day long so there's no way he can drink so he can't be drunk before we go. I mean, just all this plotting and planning that you have to do, you know, to be clever enough. You know, you can't be clever enough. Alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, just give it its due. That's just exactly what it is. You know, and when I'm doing the wrong thing, how it's so hard for me to get off that path. You know, I keep forcing it and forcing it, you know, because I always live under the illusion, you know, that if at first you don't succeed, try again. You know, that was my motto for a long time. It darn near killed me. You know, and then one time, you know, bazooka bubblegum, you know how they have those little fortunes on the bottom of it? I got a bazooka bubblegum fortune, and it said, if at first you don't succeed, you're doing it wrong. Whoa, you know, it never occurred to me, you know, to do it differently. It just keep pushing, you know. And, you know, and the disease of alcoholism to me is full of contradictions, you know, because it has to be to keep itself going. It just has to be. And, you know, after I'd eat myself alive with feeling guilty about, you know, why can't I fix this for him? Why, you know, why aren't I, you know, don't I love him enough? Doesn't he love me enough after going through all of that stuff? You know, after I beat that dead horse to pieces, then I got to, you know, to have the family disease of alcoholism continue, we've got to go to the next thing. So I go to the complete opposite of guilt for me, which is martyrdom. You know, that's just like the complete opposite because it's like, you know, like, I don't know if you guys do the Al-Anon jokes or something. The A's love to tell them, and some of them are pretty funny. I like the Al-Anon salute. You know, this thing, you know, and that's, you know, and really, and I don't know why they call it the Al-Anon salute, because it's really the pre-Al-Anon salute, you know, because that was the deal for me. Because after I beat myself to death about feeling guilty, now I go to the complete opposite, and now I'm the martyr. How I suffer, how many sacrifices I make, how much do I have to bleed here, how much do I have to give up of myself for him to be okay? You know, and just this vicious cycle that just keeps feeding off of itself and feeding off of itself. And it just gets ridiculous. We have a friend, Rebecca, and she pretty much tells it like it is. If you whine too much at the meeting, she's like, you hear in the back, I get off the cross, we need the wood. And I love it because it's the truth. You know, I mean, it's enough already. And my husband and I, when he first got sober, we went to a couples group for a while, you know, and it was AA and Al-Anons, and they were all married couples. And of course, like I say, you know, I'm new and I don't know, you know, I kind of lament and carry on and do my thing. And this guy in AA one time after I was done sharing, he said, you know, Larsine, if you're going to walk on water, will you get out of the boat and get someone else room who, you know, who really needs a ride on the boat? And that was it for me because in my own mind, I was walking on water. You know, I made all these sacrifices and getting out of that mode of thinking about, not so much about what you sacrifice, but your part, you know. you know, certain sacrifices anybody makes in any kind of relationship. That's what having a relationship is. It's give and it's take. It's back and it's forth, and that's the way the deal is. But if I look at it as a constant state of the sacrifices I made so that you could, so that this could happen, so that that could happen, then I don't appreciate my marriage. Today I do things in my marriage that sometimes it involves some sort of sacrifice on my part, but I do it willingly. I do it because I love this person unconditionally, and that's what I'm willing to do to help the marriage along, to do what needs to be done. I don't sacrifice myself. I don't lay myself out on the block anymore or whatever, but I am willing to make certain sacrifices, you know, if it's presented to me in a way that that's what needs to be done, you know, for our marriage to go on and things to get better. Then that means I have to make some sacrifices. That means my husband makes sacrifices sometimes, too. That's the deal. He goes to some of my family functions, which I know for him are not fun, you know, but he makes that sacrifice to go for me. And I appreciate it, you know, and it's just the way, it's just the things that he's willing to do for me, you know, to make our marriage stronger, because I've learned to trust him and have faith in him, you know, and I've learned to give him his credit. He's a good person, and he brings that to our marriage. Anyway, guilt and martyrdom, now I'm off to self-righteousness. Yay, self-righteousness. I remember one time I was in a big old fight with my husband, and in the middle of the fight, he called me a self-righteous bitch. And I thought, well, I don't know why he paid me a compliment in the middle of the fight. I mean, granted, he could have left the bitch part off, but, you know, but I heard self-righteous, you know. And I mean, and in my mind, again, my definition, never looking it up, in my mind, what self-righteousness means is that you're right and you know it. You know, I mean, that's what it is. And obviously, he was knowing I was right, too. That's what I heard when he said that to me that day. That's how sick I am. And I functioned under that definition, you know, for many, many years. You know, and then again, I look up the actual definition of self-righteousness. It's convinced of one's own righteousness, especially in contrast with the actions and beliefs of others. Narrow-mindedly moralistic. Holy crapola. Anybody here want to be narrow-mindedly moralistic? Please raise your hand. I mean, it just was like, and that's how I was. It was like my way or the highway. This is the way, you know, and again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. Those negative character traits in me that just got made bigger and bigger and bigger until that's all I was about. That's all I was about, sitting on my high horse, looking down at him, giving him no end of grief about what he was doing, not ever recognizing the fact that he suffers from a disease, you know, but it wasn't a choice that he made willingly on his own, you know, and how did I stop doing that, you know, again, coming down on, and the simple slogans are wonderful, live and let live. When I first started coming down on, I thought it was just kind of really like, let live, you know, I mean, it was just because that was a big gift for me to let anybody just live, you know, because I just wanted to punish everybody, you know, but it's one of my absolutely favorite slogans today, you know, because I do get into big time judgment and doing all those kinds of things. And again, it's one more time, my personality, and it's a character defect. I have to work on it. You know, it's not an issue. My husband makes a big thing about issues. They're not issues. They're character defects. Recognize them for what they are. Then you can do something about them. And so that's what I, you know, that's how I try and always get past that, is just to remember, live and let live. Everybody's doing the best they can. Why the heck wouldn't they be? You know, who doesn't want to have a happy, joyous life? You know, everybody's doing the best they can, and that's just what I have to focus on all the time. Not just Larsine, everybody's doing the very best that they can. You know, and letting my children live their own lives, that's so hard for me. Why? Because they're children. And then they're adults. Now, see, my children are adults. My children are 29 and 26 years old. But in my mind, they're always my children, and I got the big focus on that, and it's very, very difficult for me with those guys. And knowing that what I think is best for them, you know, I'm a 48-year-old woman in Al-Anon. Now, why would a 48-year-old woman want be good for a 29-year-old guy or a 26-year-old guy? But yet I want to push all that on them because, and I say it's because I want them to be happy, when in reality, it's because I want me to be happy. If this is what my 29-year-old son and 26-year-old son are doing, then I'll be happy. And God, isn't it all about me anyway? You know, when the deal is they got to find happiness on their own path. They have to find it their own way. You know, and how they're happy is, if they're happy, then that's the deal. That's what it's about. That's all that it's about. My happiness, I got to do the things I got to do that make me happy. Not what my mother thinks that, you know, would make me happy. You know, what I think is good for me to be happy. And again, one more time. If I'm doing the best that I think I can, why don't I think my boys are doing the best that they can? Look at their teacher. You know, that's the bottom line. You know, look at the teacher. And, you know, and what I've known today pretty much, you know, with kids it can be such a hard deal. I go in my head over and over again with the drinking, how hard that must have been. What were they feeling? What were they thinking? I think that now. I never thought that then. Never even crossed my mind. Never even did, you know. And again, I'm not proud of that. It's where the disease of alcoholism took me. But I think about it all the time now. And when I was first new and I was doing my fourth and my fifth step, and oh my God, the guilt and all that stuff, the mom, you know, I'm the sober parent. Look how I just really messed these kids up and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and I'm talking to them and I, you know, and I do what I always do, you know, I talk it to death, you know, and stuff. You know, and the fact that, mom, we're okay. It's not your fault. We forgive you, you know. I mean, it's all right. And because I want it to be all right. I don't want to think that I've done things to mess up my children. And, you know, and what I know pretty much now is that no matter what's all happened, every single day I did the best I had with what I had. And that has to be okay sometime along the road. Sometime along the road, when do you ever forgive yourself and let the deal go? You know, and now I look at my boys pretty much and I know today that I've given them the best stuff that I have to give them. I've made the amends, you know, I've done the footwork that we talk about in the program when it comes to all my relationships with my husband, with my children. I've done the best deal I know how to do. And now I got to let it go. And now I just simply, positively have to let it go. And when they're doing stuff I don't like, you know, I don't like what's going on, but I love them. I love them unconditionally. And again, that's something that I got to learn here. You know, and all that self-righteousness, that's what takes, you know, the bottom line, where, you know, the deepest, awfulest place you go, as far as I'm concerned, in the family disease of alcoholism, is the hatred and the anger. I mean, because that is just the deal. I mean, that to me is the absolute worst place to be in. And I lived there so often. I mean, it was just when you wake up and you wake up with hate. You just wake up with that awful feeling, just that I hate my life, I hate everything that's going on around me, and I can see nothing. I can see no hope. And there's a lady who just died a few years ago, Martha Parsons. She was in Al-Anon for, I don't know, 48 million years. And she was great. She came into Al-Anon in 1954, and her husband was sober for 6 months, and he went back out drinking, and he never got sober again. But she continued to come to Al-Anon, and she was just the light that's always in the room, just this person who lived from the very beginning, you know, through, you know, till the day she died in the disease of alcoholism. And but you'd never know it to look at this woman. You never know it to hear her share in a meeting because, you know, the recovery was her. It was just the way that it was. And but Martha, whenever she would share, she would always say, when I first came to Al-Anon, I went there and I asked them, how do you get the look off your face? You know, and I mean, and that just hit me like a brick, you know. I mean, because it's just, no matter how hard you work the program, if you still got the look on your face, you know, I mean, that's the deal, you know. And for me, it was the look. I mean, I just would have that look on my face. And it was very funny because a few weeks ago, months ago, it was this year, my husband was doing something bad. You can imagine that. And I tried to give him the look. And because he looked at me after I tried to give him the look, and he said, you can't give the look anymore. You know, I was like, oh, no, tell my boss the look, you know. Every so often, you need the look, you know. So it's all the wrong, you know. Trying to give them, you know, the look that only you can give your alcoholic, you know, that your alcoholic can feel the other side of the room. You know, I remember being at parties when my husband was drinking and just flashing them, you know, when you catch their eyes and just shooting them that look, you know, and they know right away that they're in trouble, you know, and then, of course, they're drunk, so they're like, well, look at Mercy, and she's giving me the look over there. And then, of course, everybody at the party looks at you like, what's the matter with you? You know, but I always think about the look, you know. And so I try and remind myself, you know, when I'm especially when I'm talking to those people that I love the most, am I giving them the look? You know, am I giving them the look that I'm not paying any attention, that you're stupid, that I know better than you? You know, that's the look, and I don't want to have that look. These are the people that I love. I want them to know that I love them. You know, not that I have all these preconceived notions about that I think they're stupid or they should listen to me. And anyway, and then again, one more time, the definition of hate, looking that up in the dictionary. Intense hostility and aversion, usually deriving from fear, anger, or a sense of injury. You know, and they say there's a fine, fine line between love and hate. You know, and I know what that line is today. That line is the disease of alcoholism. You know, that is positively. You know, we talk about the invisible line that the alcoholic crosses, but that line is the line of alcoholism. You know, and that to me is where the love and the hate. You know, I go back and forth across it all the time. You know, and when I'm living in the active family disease, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, hate just permeates me. That's just what goes on, you know. And when I cross over, when I'm working my program, you know, that's when the love gets to come back in. You know, alcoholism can't do anything about that love. Nothing at all. But when I cross over, that's why towards the end of the drinking, that's all it was for me. 24/7 was hate, because I was constantly, you know, this on the alcoholism side of that line, even though I'm not the person that's drinking. That's where I was living and breathing and eating and doing all my stuff. And it just got, you know, it just got worse and worse and worse. And, you know, and I hated my life. I absolutely hated my life. And about 6 years ago, I had to change jobs. And I've been working for this guy, and he retired, and my job went away. And I've been working in the secretarial field my whole life, and they wanted to put me over in HR and have me do something different over there, and I was not happy about it. I didn't want to be doing this stuff, and I resisted the change. And I had to go do some stuff that I wasn't used to doing, and I didn't get the signatures in the right order. And so I'm running amok, and I remember walking after I, you know, missed the signature, and I was trying, and the lady was at break, and all this stuff was going on. I remember walking down the hallway at work, and I said out loud, I hate my life. And it was like, you know, and again, one more time, God tapping me on the shoulder. Because it was like that revelation about when I really used to hate my life. You know, when I absolutely, in the disease of alcoholism, hated getting up every single day. That was the revelation back to me. One more time, you know, I'm not into acceptance. I'm not into what's going on for me right now. And that quickly, I can go back to hating my life. Hate's a really strong word. You know, and I had a good life then. I mean, I was in Al-Anon. I'm going to meetings. I'm working the program. You know, but I hated my life that particular moment because one more time I gave the power of it over to somebody else. You know, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't my higher power. It was because I didn't, things weren't going the way Larcine wants them to go. So let's just hate it. You know, and when, I don't know about you guys, but throwing hate never fixed nothing for me. It never fixed anything. Hate feeds on itself. You know, one more time, you know, and it's such a crucial part to alcoholism. Hate's essential. You got to have it, or you're not going to have that family disease going on in your life. You know, and think about when you're angry. You know, I think about when I'm angry. There's not one time that I can think about any good that ever came out of my being mad, that any good that ever came out of me yelling at anybody. You know, service-oriented or wise, you know, if I call up the telephone company yelling and screaming, the guy isn't really anxious to get to my house. You know, I don't know if he's anxious to get to yours. You know, and the person on the other end of the phone isn't, oh, well, thank you for yelling and screaming and tearing me a new one. You know, I'll be sure to assist you in any way I possibly can. You know, and I mean, and think about it. That's how I feel when people start yelling at me. And again, you know, this yelling, crazy, you know. They say, you know, you should never argue with an idiot because people watching won't know which one the idiot is. And, you know, and think about it. You know, when you see two people yelling, do you think one of them is right and one of them is wrong? You know, I don't know how you feel, but when I see two people fighting, I think they're both idiots. You know, I mean, that's just the deal. You know, it's the same thing about you should never, you know, get in a mud wrestling match with a pig because the pig likes it. And you both get dirty, you know, and that's the deal. And that's how I was with alcoholism. I was fighting, you know, I was wrestling with alcoholism like you're wrestling with the pig. And I got just as dirty. I got just as dirty wrestling with this, you know, this disease. And, you know, and I just, you know, like I say, it's never ever made me feel better about myself or good about myself. And I mean, and granted, there's a certain amount of tension, you know, that after you've yelled and screamed, and then what do? You pass out in exhaustion. You know, and when your life is so pathetic that that's the only relief you get, you know, that you have to eat so that you can pass out in exhaustion. I mean, that's just where the disease of alcoholism took me. And again, I'm not even the person that's drinking. That's just the way that it worked for me. You know, and again, it's justifiable. I justify my anger. And I think that justifiable anger is as deadly to the Al-Anon as drinking is to the alcoholic. You know, because, boy, I can sure justify it. I can, his behavior, you know. How do you not go crazy behind that? How do you not get mad? You know, how does that not affect you that way? You know, and one more time, it's because I'm taking on someone else's responsibilities. I'm trying to make someone be who they're not capable of being. And it's just absolutely crazy, you know? You know, and the first way I got to get past all that anger is remember that I am dealing with alcoholism. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, and how is alcoholism cunning, baffling, and powerful? Because it disguises itself. It disguises itself as somebody I love. You know, and I think that that's what I'm after, you know. And what I'm doing, I'm not hurting alcoholism at all. I'm hurting the alcoholic, no doubt about that. Poking him all full of kinds of holes. You know, but hurting the alcoholic never does anything to the alcoholism. You know, just again, it's just like it's just sitting there, just feeding on the hate over and over and over again. So the first thing I need to learn to do is to separate the person from the disease. You know, and I was so grateful to hear that when I got here. You know, that it's okay to hate the disease of alcoholism, you know, but you don't hate the person that has it. You have to learn to separate that. You know, and the first thing I have to do in order to do that is acknowledge that that person suffers from it, that that person suffers from the disease of alcoholism. You know, and like I shared last night, I don't. I can take a drink or not take a drink. It doesn't make a hill of beans to me. And it was very difficult for me in the beginning to understand alcoholism as a disease. you know, because I'm like, it's just, you know, you just make up your mind. You know, you drink or you don't drink. You know, I grew up in all this, you know, you discipline yourself to do this or you do that. Well, maybe that's what works in my DNA, but it doesn't work in an alcoholic's DNA. You know, my husband, I don't have to have cancer to acknowledge that cancer is a disease or leukemia is a disease or anything else like that. All I need to know is my husband suffers from the disease of alcoholism. That once he takes the first drink, his choices are now over. It's a done deal. Alcoholism is going to take him wherever it's going to take him. He has no choice no longer. You know, and that's the disease of alcoholism. It takes people that way. I was sharing last night, we were talking about, you know, understanding alcoholism and how you explain it to people who don't drink. And it's really difficult because a lot of people don't. I mean, my husband, you know, is coming up on his 24th birthday, and we've had these friends who have been our friends since high school. And they still don't understand that, you know, they're like, you just can't even have one beer. You know, they just can't quite get the concept, you know, of the fact that you can't drink. And it's difficult, no doubt about it. You know, for people who don't have that problem, it's difficult. For people who don't live with that problem, it's hard to understand. But, you know, how what helped me one time understand a little bit about the compulsion to drink was that I was, again, at a conference, and there was an AA woman that was speaking from the podium. And she was talking about having her little 3 or 4 year old son had surgery, and how she was sitting next to him in his little hospital crib bed there. And you know how you feel if you've ever had surgery. It's very painful afterwards, you know, when you're kind of coming out of it, and how the child was crying and sobbing. And because it was so great for her, the pain was so great for her, her only coping mechanism is to drink. She had to leave. She had to walk out the door to her son's crying voice, begging his mother not to leave in order for, you know, because she had to go and drink. You know, and to me, I don't know, it just kind of a little bit, for me, clarified, you know, what it must be to have that compulsion to drink. I'm grateful that I don't have that in my life, you know. And I feel, you know, the utter compassion for those people that do today. I can't imagine, you know, what could take you away from your own sick child. But again, you know, it just shows you how cunning, baffling, and powerful the disease of alcoholism is. You know, and then, you know, and besides, you know, acknowledging that my husband suffers from it, you know, more importantly, I need to learn to take the focus off of him. I got to put it on me. I just got to look at what I can do. How do I stop being angry at you? I quit looking at you. If you're making me mad, I got to quit looking. You know, that's just the trigger that goes on. Now, granted, it's hard not to watch alcoholics. They just do stuff. They do big stuff, you know. I mean, it's hard not to look at some of the big stuff that they do because they're just out there. But when I find it making me angry, I've got to look away. And then again, one more time, turn the focus on to me. Why? Because that's the only thing I can do something about. Do I want to be mad today? Do I want to be pissed today? If I do, I just got to watch them, and I'll get there right away. You know, and it's amazing how when I stop looking at everybody else, you know, and I start looking at myself and see my part in what's going on, you know, how much more tolerant I become of you. Because now I need you to be tolerant of me. Because some days I'm not the happy person in the family. Some days I'm the one that's being really difficult. Some day I'm the person that's just not fun to be with. And again, I expect, you know, you to compensate for me for that. Aren't I entitled to have a bad day? But boy, I sure don't want you to have one, because that means that it's going to affect me, and I'm going to have to get mad, and then blah, blah, blah. That vicious circle just starts all over again. You know, and then all of that, you know, and all of those things, when I was doing them and living them, all totally masked by denial. You know, denial. That's the big deal, for, you know, in Al-Anon, I think, is, you know, that I suffered from the most is just my total denial of the truth of what was going on in my life. You know, I look back on all those negative emotions, every single one of them, and denial is the one that blows my mind the most, because I'm reality queen. You know, I'm in your face telling you how it is and what it's like. But denial of what was going on in my own family that I just could not see. And again, that's how alcoholism, that's how it affects me. And I'm not the drinker. And, you know, but reality slips away from me as easily as it does from the alcoholic. Why is that? You know, one more time, it's just unbelievable. And again, understanding ourselves, I love what it says in there. Those who are close to the alcoholic begin to pretend. We accept promises. We believe. We want to believe the problem has gone away each time there was a sober period. When every good sense tells us there's something wrong with the alcoholic's drinking and thinking, we still hide how we feel and what we know. And this is our denial. And I always love when every good sense tells us. You know, because, you know, it's just like, I guess it's like compensating for the craziness that goes along with the drinking. Having to make sense out of it is what made me crazy. Like one time my husband went and got drunk for 3 days because I served canned peas for dinner. I mean, that was the reason, you know. So I have to justify and make that reason be okay. You know, I mean, I still have trouble with canned peas today. I didn't walk down the canned pea aisle of the supermarket, you know. I mean, it's just a bad place for me to go. But when you are talking to someone and that's the reality they're giving you, and that is their reality, That's their reality. My husband believed that because I serve canned peas that he had to go out and get drunk for 3 days. I have to make sense of that. I remember one time he promised me he wasn't going to drink anymore. We were in a really bad spot in our marriage. Things were really hitting the skids. And he arranged for a babysitter. He wanted to go out so we could talk. He promised me there would be no drinking. And so we go to this little Italian restaurant, and the first thing he does is he orders a carafe of wine. And I say to him, I thought you said you weren't going to drink. And he says to me, I'm not drinking. This is wine. Now, again, you know, alcohol, wine. Now, it's not like you can stand up in the restaurant and take a group conscience, you know. I mean, you know, I'm by myself. I have to make a snap decision right now, right here. You know, and again, because I'm affected in such a negative way, well, maybe for him, wine isn't drinking. Because, yeah, he does drink whiskey and he does drugs and all that. So wine is like water to him. And again, you're making, you know, taking crazy stuff and trying to make sense out of it so that I can function. Because my world has to make some sense or I'm going to go stark, raving, lunatic, mad.